Thank you. And I'm excited to be here with Alicia Atala-May. She is the Social Determinants of Health Manager at the Oregon Primary Care Association, who has been one of our integral partners on this project. So Pam's presentation is a great segue to our presentation. You're going to hear me say this a lot, but to really figure out the needs of your patients, you need to collect data on their social determinants of health complexity. And if we really want to change the system, she mentioned that Medicare and Medicaid funding for social services have been cut in half. One of the big barriers is just a lack of funding for these organizations. We need to collect that data to demonstrate patient complexity, what their needs really are, how you're responding to those needs, and then to show the impact it has on outcomes and costs, to really change the conversation on payment for these types of services to ensure that they are reimbursable and sustainable. And so we're excited today to talk about a tool and a toolkit that would allow you to collect standardized data at the patient level on social determinants of health, and then how can you really use that data for care transformation and then policy and payment reform. This has been a very multi-partner initiative, so I'm with the National Association of Community Health Centers, but we've been working this entire time with the Oregon Primary Care Association and then the Association of Asian Pacific Community Health Organizations and the Institute for Alternative Futures. And this is thanks to funding from the Kresge Foundation, the Blue Shield Foundation of California, and then Kaiser Permanente. We have nothing to disclose. So why is it important to collect this data? I kind of talked about this a little bit before, but we have a lot of information that social determinants impact downstream factors like health behaviors, health conditions, health outcomes, but we just really lack that standardized data at the patient level of what exactly those how many social determinants a patient may have, what is their relationship with interventions, figure out what interventions work best on those social determinants. So what we really hope to do, we developed a tool that would allow you to collect data at the patient level on social determinants. It's called the Protocol for Responding to and Assessing Patient Assets, Risks, and Experiences. And we had a handout that we handed out to several of you. We have a couple more handouts up here if you want to come, but this has the tool on it, so it's always helpful to refer to the types of questions that we're asking. But this is also available for download. If you click on that session in the online APHA program, you can download it there as well. But what we really hope you can use this data for is, first and foremost, inform care at the patient level. If you have a better idea of what your patient's needs are and understand them more as a whole person, then you can really inform care and improve their health. So, for example, you may prescribe medications for a patient, but maybe they can't fill the prescriptions because they can't afford it. So having that information would be helpful to have either a 340B discount drug pricing program, or make sure you always do generic drugs. You know, it's just helpful to have that information. At a community level, it's important to better understand your patient population and then figure out what the community's needs are. So an example could be, maybe you've discovered that there are a couple neighborhoods that are really having transportation issues. You may have not known that before, but once you know that, you could potentially work with the transportation agency in that local area to advocate for new bus routes to those areas to make sure that they can come and reach the services that they need. And then at a more policy level, we really want to level the playing field so that providers that are serving more complex patients aren't being penalized in regards to their outcomes. Plans are looking at outcome measures now, and you're being held accountable for your outcomes, and it's not fair necessarily if you're serving much more complex patients and doing all that you can, but yet you're being held at the same level as providers that could be serving a highly insured, you know, higher income population. So we want to use it for risk adjustment. And then again, for the payment reform aspect, you need to document that your patients are more complex, you are providing these services or working with these partners to really meet their needs, but in order to sustain them, you need to show that they are effective, but we really want to change those payment models to make sure that those services are being reimbursed or provided for in some more sustainable fashion. So how do we create this tool? I'm going to breeze through this a little bit because we've presented on it in years past. We really want to dive into how you can really implement it and then use the data. But just so everyone knows, we did a very large environmental scan to inform the development of this tool. It was based on a review of the literature, monitoring national initiatives and making sure our work aligned with national initiatives, so like Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Healthy People 2020, the Institute of Medicine, ICD-10, National Quality Forum. We looked at existing protocols from the field and made sure we learned from those. And then we engaged stakeholders at multiple points throughout the development process to make sure that it met their needs and was the information that they wanted. This is just to show the alignment of what social determinants we have in our tool and how it aligns with other national initiatives. The two main ones I want to point out are ICD-10, so in that third column right there, ICD-10 has a set of Z codes that focus on social factors, so it's great that you have a standardized list of codes that you can use. And then also meaningful use. So the final rule for meaningful use stage 3 came out maybe about 3-4 weeks ago. And what's interesting with that rule is that it stated that for electronic health records that are supposed to be certified under meaningful use, they need to have the capability to collect data on 10 social determinants of health. And our tool aligns very well with those 10 social determinants, and so that's going to be really important going forward as well. So for those that have the tool, you can obviously see, but for those that don't, our tool asks essentially 15 questions to assess 14 social determinants. But we also have 6 optional domains that include incarceration history, transportation, refugee status, country of origin, safety, and domestic violence. Turn it over to Alicia.
So you see here a timeline of the project, and year one, 2014, was really focused on, as Michelle just highlighted, the development of the tool. So that environmental scan, working with our brain trust of experts in this area, et cetera. This year has been really exciting and very busy, and the teams that are formerly part of this pilot, the learning community teams, have been really piloting the tool. So what that means is kind of two main pieces. One, the clinics that are piloting PREPARE have been really testing it out with their population of focus that represents their overall clinic population. So developing the workflows to use PREPARE, when is it being implemented, at what point in a patient encounter, who are the staff that are administering PREPARE, et cetera. And then along with that, also we have the health center networks that are building PREPARE into the electronic health record platforms used by the clinics in the learning community. So that's been a really robust body of work. And then next year we'll be focused on disseminating the tool, so sharing our work and spreading the tool as broadly as we can and also sharing learnings from this pilot project. So this gives you more of an overview of what the pilot for building and testing out the PREPARE tool has really consisted of. And what you'll see here is that, as I mentioned, there's these learning community teams, there's 4 teams, and each of those teams is made up of a health center network and at least 1 clinic. Some of them have more, as you'll see. And each of these teams has been piloting the PREPARE tool, as I mentioned, building it into the EHR platforms listed there on the right side. So we have NextGen, eClinical Work, Centricity, and Epic. And those in combination make up the EHRs most commonly used by community health centers. And also these teams are really spread across the country, so it's been really interesting to have a broad learning from all of those different communities. So this, I'm just going to move through quickly, but as you'll see here, kind of the different areas of work that we've taken on. Currently, the teams have really just finished implementing PREPARE with their population of focus, 400 patients. Again, that's representative of their overall clinic population. And we're now really looking at that data. So what did we learn about the social risk factors, the assets, et cetera, that are experienced by the patients we're seeing in community health centers? And also another really exciting piece of this is that we're going to be cross-tabulating that data with clinical health outcomes data. So we really have the opportunity to see how a person's social determinants of health has impact and is connected to health outcomes. And then at the top, I also want to highlight, as Michelle mentioned earlier, that we are working on developing kind of a broader action toolkit that really comes out of recognition of the fact that it's so important for folks not only to be able to collect this data, but to be able to act on it. And with that need, we've heard quickly, or we've heard often and frequently that folks really want support in figuring out how to do that, how to intervene. So whether you're building capacity within your own health center or building those robust community partnerships to refer out to those services and interventions that are needed, that's a really key piece of this work. So feedback so far, we've gotten a lot of really great feedback, both from the formal pilot teams that I mentioned and also from others that have been experimenting with PREPARE. First and foremost, we've heard that it really supports the deepening of relationships between patients and clinical staff and providers. So that's been a really important piece. Patients, if you go down to the bottom piece, patients appreciate being asked. And it's been really interesting to learn about how PREPARE creates an opportunity for the experiences and concerns and issues that folks are dealing with in their day-to-day lives to really be brought in as valid and valued in a visit to a clinic. It's easy to use, so on average it takes about 3 to 5 minutes to implement the whole tool. And folks like the range of questions being asked. So as you'll see if you have the handout, we do cover, as Michelle mentioned, a variety of domains pretty broadly.
So you may be wondering, how can I really implement this? You know, how much time is it really going to lengthen that visit? We do so many things already. How can we incorporate one more data collection project? So we wanted to kind of walk you through some of the best practices and lessons learned that we've gathered from our pilot testing teams throughout the country. So first step is you got to introduce the project. You got to go through some change management and educate staff and kind of get their buy-in as to why it's important to engage in this initiative. So some of the major barriers that we've heard from the clinics is, one, people don't really understand why they're engaging in this. So a good solution kind of message for that is you want to better understand your patients and your patient needs to provide better care. While it may have these other policy implications, for especially staff on the ground, it's really important to bring it back to the patient and really making sure that you're providing for the whole patient and all of their needs. So that message seems to ring pretty true with a lot of data collection staff. Again, another big challenge is how are we going to implement yet one more project on top of everything else that we're already doing? And an interesting thing about this is that you find those linkages of where it could be complementary work or build on work you're already doing or add value to work you're already doing. Let's say you're in an accountable care organization. Again, if you better understand your patient's needs and then are able to provide services to meet those needs, probably lead to savings and better outcomes. So then hopefully you can reinvest those savings to do other services or initiatives. Or maybe you're doing something on care management, having a more better understanding of your patients can help you streamline those care management programs. So just think about how you could potentially tie it into work you're already doing. We didn't go into this that much, but if you look at the tool, you'll notice it's kind of pretty broad questions. And we did that purposefully, knowing that people are engaging in a lot of other initiatives or projects. So while you could collect potentially more granular level data for other initiatives, you could roll it up to the questions that we're asking, again, for that aggregation purposes, for population health management, and for policy purposes. So the next step is figuring out what workflow would work best for this tool. So you need to first figure out what your current workflow is, and then to see where could it fit in that workflow, or do you potentially need to alter or modify your workflow to allow for a little bit more data collection. People have found that the Five Rights framework works really well to figure out a workflow, and that you find the right information, you give it to the right person at the right time and the right format through the right channel. So they found that to be pretty helpful. And some of the biggest challenges were, you know, how do we implement this without increasing visit time? And a big lesson learned was find that value added time. The patient most likely will be waiting at some point during their visit, so how do you really use that waiting time such that you're not adding anything else on, but the patient isn't just sitting there? So this could be in the waiting room or even after the patient has been roomed in the exam room but hasn't seen the provider yet. Another solution could be to incorporate into other assessments that you may be doing. So you may be doing some depression screenings or health risk assessments, and so those might be complementary and lend themselves to each other as well. That's another solution we found. So the next step is to collect the data. This is just a table to show different types of data collection models that our health centers have been pilot testing, so I'm going to highlight just a couple of them. So you may want to use non-clinical staff during that value-added time when the patient is just waiting for either the provider or to be roomed. But the nice thing about using non-clinical staff, such as case managers or patient advocates, patient navigators, is that most likely that the person who is collecting that information can then respond and act on that information in regards to referring them to services or providing them with a community resource guide and making those connections. Maybe you want potentially a more clinically trained person to collect this information, so you could potentially have a nurse or a medical assistant do it in the exam room after they've taken the vitals and the reason for the visit, but still, again, waiting for the provider. But then the nice thing about that is that you're having a clinically trained person to collect this information and then act on it. We literally just got the final pilot data on Friday, so this is a previous, the first round of pilot data, but this is just a smattering of data that we've collected from the health centers. So I just want to let people see and visualize what you would do if you knew this about your patient population. If you know that your patient population, that 85% of them came from a country other than the United States, and about 80% of them speak a language other than English, or that almost half of your patient has less than a high school degree, or that a quarter of your patients have transportation issues such that they can't get to their medical appointments. Just think about what services you think that your organization would need, or what community partners would you need to partner with to really help your patients. And then finally, step four is using the data. And we'll talk some more best practices and case studies from our pilot testers. But once you get that kind of patient level and patient population level information, then you can figure out, okay, what resources do we already have in-house, or what resources do we already have in the community? One of the patient center medical home, not requirements, but one of the things you could do to be accredited is developing that community resource guide. So there's some extra incentive there to potentially develop what community resources are available to refer your patients to, or develop those partnerships or strengthen partnerships. Then the next is do that gap analysis. Okay, we have these needs, but we don't really have the services to meet these needs. So where do we need to potentially build partnerships, or where do we potentially need to build more services? A big resistance from people from the get-go was their fear of collecting this information, but then fearing that they wouldn't be able to do anything about it. You know, it's a huge issue. You know, it's very disrespectful to ask this of patients. It's very sensitive information. If you can't do anything about it, you know, what's the point? Medicine's first, do no harm. But a good message that we found that seems to ring pretty true is that you have to start somewhere, and you have to do the best that you can with what you have, but collecting this information is going to help you figure out what services to provide. So it's just important, you have to start somewhere and then figure out what's the need. This is also kind of similar to Pam's talk, but we also believe that it's not enough just to collect data on patient complexity. You also need standardized data on what you're doing about it and what services you're providing to meet these needs. So health centers do what's called enabling services, so kind of non-clinical services to help patients access or receive care. So that could be transportation, translation, case management, those types of things. And fortunately, one of our partners, APCHO, the Association of Asian Pacific Community Health Organizations, has developed a standardized tool to collect data on those enabling services. So they have these sets of codes that link to the enabling service, but then they also have the amount of time that particular enabling service provider is spending with the patient, so 10 minutes, 20 minutes, up to 90 minutes. So again, patient complexity, showing that what you're doing and what's involved in what you're doing, marry those two together, really hopefully move the dial on alternative payment methods to make sure that those types of services are reimbursable and thus sustainable. All right, and very quickly, so here are some examples of what our pilot testers are already doing with just the pilot data that they have. So you could do it in kind of three buckets: inform care and services, inform payment, and then inform risk adjustment. So one health center is, they brought in a local transportation agency, and they are building a more formal partnership with them, but they're advocating that if they can get like a bulk discount on bus tokens or taxi vouchers, because they're finding that transportation is a huge need in their community and that their bus tokens and their taxi vouchers are running out before the end of the year. So they're making that more formal partnership to do that. We have one health center working with an outside agency to really come up with a risk score. So using that risk score for risk adjustment and be like, most of our patients are a risk score of out of 1 out of 10, you know, they are an 8. You know, they're very complex patients. And again, just to make that equal playing field such that they could advocate that, you know, their patients are much more complex, so they have to do all of these different things to really take care of their patients.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about one other group of clinics that have been experimenting with repair, those 11 clinics that are part of Oregon's alternative payment and care methodology. And I'm not going to talk too much about that except to share a little bit about what you see here. The goals of that effort are really around using alternative payment models to allow clinics to really transform the care that they're providing to their patients. So efforts are really around improving clinic population outcomes, improving patient and staff engagement, and then increasing access to services and containing costs. And we really see segmentation, as you'll see there on the right, as being one kind of channel through which to get at those outcomes. So we brought PREPAIR to this group of clinics and asked them to experiment with it on a very small scale. So we just had them work with three questions. So if you have the tool, the questions that we selected were the ones around stress and social isolation, and then the one around material resources, access to materials and resources. And then we asked the clinics to just use those, pilot those questions with 10 of their patients, so very small scale. And then we asked them to think through the questions that you see here. So we wanted to kind of hear about their process. How did they use PREPAIR? How did they ask these questions? And what did they observe when they were doing so? So how did patients respond? And we also wanted to know if asking these questions led to other conversations around the patient's health. So as Michelle mentioned, some of these questions are broad, and we really see opportunity to get more granular and also kind of lead into other conversations. So then we brought the clinics together at an in-person event and asked them to share their experience, and the feedback was really in line with what we'd heard from our pilot teams, which is just that they really felt like they understood their patients better, and that engaging around the social determinants of health really equalized the relationship between clinic staff and providers and patients in terms of kind of that power balance. Again, the experience that they were having in their day-to-day lives are really relevant. Some clinics express wanting more ownership of the tool, so I think we've really looked at balancing need for standardization across clinics and also recognizing that each community is so different and we need to support them in being able to respond in a specific targeted way according to the needs and resources in their community. Overall, there was a lot of excitement around being able to now work with patients in identifying their social risks and responding to those identified.
And then We're out of time, but I will just move it to these resources are available to you, and so you can find them here. But thank you.